Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a book reading and question-and-answer session with our special guest, Kurt Anderson, the host of Studio 360 and author of the new novel, True Believers, which followed a special screening of the first James Bond film, Dr. No, starring Sean Connery and Ursula Andress, with Joseph Wiseman in the title role. This program, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the release of the first film in the James Bond series, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, August 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Dr. No, directed by Terrence Young, was premiered in London, England on October 5, 1962. The fairly simple plot, secondary to the action-adventure aspect which became the major trademark of the James Bond series, concerns British Secret Service agent James Bond, 007, investigating the disappearance of a missing colleague in Jamaica, which leads him to the island of the mysterious Dr. No and a scheme to end the United States space program. True Believers is a political thriller and love story set in the 1960s and the present day, featuring a main character who is James Bond-obsessed. Here now to introduce the program is Casey Logan, Communications Coordinator at Film Streams.
We are incredibly excited to welcome Kurt Anderson back to Omaha and back to the Ruth Sokoloff Theater. I want to say, it's great to have Kurt here and on the occasion of his new novel, which, as I'm sure most of you know, has been just getting extraordinary reviews. Those of you who have read it know how well deserved that is. Those of you who are about to, you're in for a treat. I want to say, I know that that Rachel, our founder and director and fearless leader, is heartbroken that she couldn't be here tonight to welcome Kurt and Anne. I do know that I speak for Rachel when I say how grateful we are to Kurt, who's and his involvement with Film Streams from the very beginning. Kurt has been a member of our advisory board from the start. As many of you may recall, he curated one of our first repertory series out there, Nebraska and the Great Plains in the Movies, and he was back in 2007 for a special screening of Badlands that he spoke after. More recently, he was the moderator for Feature 3, our fundraiser, and interviewed Steven Soderbergh at that. And you can hear that interview if you go to studio360.org. You can check out that interview. We're incredibly excited to have him here, and I think we'll please join me in welcoming Kurt Anderson.
Thank you, Casey, and geez, thank you all of you for being here. It is I now have Film Streams as my pretext for coming back to Omaha as often as I can, and it is a pleasure. Such a pleasure to be here and to be involved with this amazing entity. I was just thinking as I was watching those trailers, I live in New York City. There is no theater this good that shows as many movies as I want to see as this one. And we certainly don't have the comfortable seats you got here. So this is an extraordinary place. So this book of mine, it's several things. It's hard to pigeonhole as one thing. It's a mystery. It's a love story. It's a portrait of the 1960s and the present day. One of the things it is, and a key thing, not just an incidental part of the story, and why we're here tonight showing this film, is the main character and her two best friends. Who I would have had grow up in Omaha, but they grew up. I figured that would be too something, and so I had them grow up in suburban Chicago, in Wilmette, in Winnetka, Illinois. And as kids, as 12-year-olds, as I'll read a little bit from the book to give you a sense, they become obsessed with James Bond. The book, as I say, is set in the present day and in the 1960s. In the present day, my main character, this woman named Karen Hollander, who's a big famous lawyer who was potentially going to be appointed to the Supreme Court, is sort of investigating why this thing she did in 1968 that nobody but she and her friends and a few people in government know about, why she was able to walk away from this crime, essentially. And so that's the plot. But this whole James Bond part of it is really takes place throughout the book. And I was just going to read a few bits from different parts of the novel to give you a sense of how the James Bond idea figures into True Believers. This first thing I'm going to read is from her. This novel is a memoir. I mean, it's a fictional memoir, obviously, because she doesn't exist. But so she's talking about her childhood when she's 12 in 1961. Her friends are Chuck and Alex. Chuck and Alex and I were not just James Bond fans. We were enthralled to James Bond. It started the summer after sixth grade. On one of those summer vacation days that waver between luxuriously open-ended and achingly dull, I happened to pick up my mom's pink hardcover copy of From Russia with Love, which I figured was some kind of soft-on communism Soviet-American romance. Around the same time, Alex read his father's brand-new hardback Thunderball. When we discovered, one afternoon at Centennial Park Swimming Pool, that we had independently discovered and fallen in love with the world of James Bond, we, as my mother enjoyed saying for the rest of her life, bonded. Up until then, I hadn't known Chuck Levy well, even though the three of us and two girls and Jimmy Graham had been the smart kids in our class, but Alex and Chuck were already best friends, and Chuck took Alex's lead in many things cultural. So at the beginning, it was just a book discussion group, like the Hobbit Fellowship my little brother Peter and his friends started a few years later. But when the wall went up in Berlin at the end of that summer, our interest in Bond spiked. The book seemed more legitimate, like extra credit reading for social studies. Alex and I had a head start on Chuck, but in the fall, he caught up quickly and then passed us, since every member of the Levy family was a certified Reading Dynamics speed reader. By Christmas vacation, we had acquired all 9 Bond books, and each of us had read every one. Although just to make sure, I created, typed, and carbon copied a 100-question exam covering the minutiae of the 8 novels and the 5 short stories. We didn't have formal meetings, but that first year, all through 7th grade, when we were alone at lunch or walking together to and from school, we'd fall into discussions of characters and scenes and plot points. Even basic facts were open to debate. We once spent days arguing over what year Bond had been born and whether he aged. Alex loved the wordplay titles, Live and Let Die and later, You Only Live Twice. But the books he liked best were Dr. No and Thunderball, because the villains had nuclear ambitions, whereas stealing gold or smuggling diamonds struck him as ordinary, uninteresting criminality. Chuck's favorite was From Russia with Love, because he thought it was the most realistic. The way, for instance, it says professional assassins start feeling guilty about killing people. What I loved about Moonraker was the fact that the villain, Sir Hugo Drax, a British industrialist, is actually a secret Nazi madman, and that the special branch operative who figures out Drax's nuclear missile plans is a young woman, Gayla Brand. It wasn't exactly a secret club. I didn't hide the books or my extreme interest from my parents. They were entertained, I learned later, by the contradiction between the soft-hearted politics I'd inherited from them and the ruthless, cold warrior fantasy life I acquired from Ian Fleming. The McAllisters wholly approved of Alex's Bond hobby. His mother, because Life magazine had reported that From Russia with Love was President Kennedy's favorite novel. His father, because it seemed like hopeful evidence for his son's fundamental manliness. One of Chuck's mother's Hadassah friends had told her that Goldfinger was anti-Semitic, which gave Chuck a new opportunity to remind her that she drove a Volkswagen. But for various unspoken reasons, we conducted ourselves discreetly. We were discreet because we were 12-year-olds, 2 boys and a girl, devoted to books that depicted sadism and boozing and nakedness and unmarried amoral strangers, including women with strippers' names, Pussy Galore, Honey Child Writer, having sex. And, of course, committing cold-blooded murder. As junior high began, we were already considered geeky, especially Alex and I. So why advertise this peculiar new strain of oddness to classmates already primed to be suspicious? But our secrecy wasn't mainly about avoiding ostracization, either. It pleased us in those days before we had many important secrets to keep, that our devotion to this fictional world of conspiracies and ciphers and agents and weapons remained unseen and shadowy. So this for the next couple of years, this gets more and more and more elaborate. They go on missions where they act out characters from Bond. Here's a bit of one of the missions they go on in their suburban Chicago neighborhoods. I kept walking up the road and glanced over at the construction site on the lake where the town's first high-rise apartment building was going up. I noticed the light in a construction trailer go off and two men stepped out. The older one, dark-haired and maybe 35, was wearing a tie, and the other, a little older with a crew cut, had on a denim jacket. The one in the necktie carried a briefcase, and the other held a thick tube several feet long under one arm. An attaché, like the ones all 00 agents carry, and the tube? A rifle case, obviously. I'd found James Bond and Felix Leiter, his CIA partner. Leiter opened the trunk of a car, a convertible, not a Bentley, just a Ford, but still, and they put the Cube Ranch attaché and rifle inside. Bond took a pint bottle from his jacket pocket and offered a swig to Leiter, who laughed loudly before taking a drink. So perfect. Alex was supposed to signal Chuck, and then they would get close enough to fire kill shots, but not so close that the men would be aware of two boys with toy guns pretending to murder them. Bond and Leiter started walking up toward the road, and I began walking after the men. They went into Luigi's, the hot dog stand everybody called Red Hots. I stood right behind them in line and saw that Leiter had an earpiece connected by a wire to a device in his jacket pocket. He announced to Bond, "New York is done." This verisimilitude almost scared me. Then he continued his report. Cubby 6, Mets 3, bottom of the 8th. Alex and Chuck arrived at Red Hots together, both panting. They stood in the doorway, looking at me, then at each other, then back at me. I nodded toward the men who were ordering. Chuck put his hand over his heart, over his pistol. I shook my head. I had a new plan. "Small onion rings and a small cherry Coke," I said to the girl behind the counter. I really didn't want the rings, but I needed my order to take a little time and come out after Bond and Leiter got theirs. At the condiment station, I slipped the cellophane wrapper off my cigarettes and poured 1 gram of a white chemical into the wrapper. I sat down on the stool next to Bond's. Alex and Chuck had gone back outside, but stood only a few feet away on the other side of the wooden half wall, looking in through the screen and eavesdropping as they pretended to ignore us. Alex was smoking, but I could see the Luger gripped in his other hand. Bond, speaking with an American accent, in order to remain incognito, was talking to Leiter about ductwork construction schedules and air change rates. Clearly a discussion of some secret poison gas system. I ate an onion ring and took the first sip of my drink. Then I turned away. The boys could see what I was doing, but not the two men, and poured the powder from the cellophane packet into my drink, stirring it with the straw. I took another sip and affected a look of quizzical surprise, smacked my lips, shook my head. "Excuse me, sir," I said to Bond, holding my cup toward him. He turned to me. "I ordered a cherry Coke, but I think they maybe gave me a vanilla one instead. Could you taste it? Would you mind?" He took a gulp and cringed. "No, that's cherry, all right, but gosh, it does taste funny. Way too sweet." Yeah, I thought so too," I said as I stood up. "Thanks." I carried my purse and drink in one hand, the onion rings in the other, and headed for the door. Perhaps the men found it strange that I didn't ask for a replacement Coke. But before they saw through my ruse, Commander Bond would be on the floor of Red Hots, trembling, paralyzed, suffering respiratory failure, seconds from death, thanks to the dose of a poison 100 times more lethal than cyanide that I had just tricked him into swallowing. 007, I said to Alex and Chuck as we waited to cross Sheridan Road, "has been terminated. We'll deal with Agent Leiter some other time." Alex was so excited about what I'd done that he stepped out of character, huffing and puffing and jumping around like a marionette. "Holy crap, Karen, you talked to the guy. What was it you put in the Coke?" His voice was cracking. "Tetrodotoxin from the Japanese pufferfish in Dr. No." No, actually. "Sweet and low?" "That took guts," Chuck said. In their eyes, I had, in one stroke, turned into a different person. No longer just the slightly argumentative girl who read the same books they did and got good grades, but unpredictable, cunning, brave, perverse, exciting. For the first time, I felt like a woman, a modern woman. We sped down Michigan Avenue, our hair and clothes flapping in the wind, looking at the vastness of the darkening lake and sky to our left, feeling masterful and free, filled with the joy of living dangerously. Of course, the actual deadly risks we were taking, the cigarettes, biking at night without lights or helmets, did not even register as dangerous. Then this movie comes out. It came out in Britain in the fall of 1962, a week after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a week before the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then came out in the United States the spring of 1963. During the year before the first Bond movie appeared, the world had come to seem even more like an Ian Fleming concoction. The resumption of nuclear weapons testing by the U.S. and the USSR, the Soviet missiles in Cuba, the new hotline between the Kremlin and the White House. The British war minister caught having an affair with a 19-year-old who was also a Soviet spy's mistress. Our Bond devotion had become even more elaborate. And then came the movie Dr. No. Starting that summer, 1963, all the other kids suddenly knew about James Bond. Wendy Reichman owned the 45 of the Dr. No theme song before I did. At the Crawford twins' pool party, everyone said Susie Crawford's white two-piece suit made her look just like Ursula Andress as Honey Rider. And Jimmy Graham pretended his glass of 7-Up was a cocktail and introduced himself repeatedly as Graham, James Graham. Chuck and Alex and I didn't say so, but our private world of fictional violence and glamour paled pathetically in comparison to Hollywood's official version. The movie explosions in particular made Chuck yearn to blow up stuff. We had been a secret cell of Cognoscenti, performing a secret homage, taking actual risks out of the real world, inventing everything on the fly, scaring and surprising ourselves. Now, all at once, Bond was like a Barbie doll or a Disney-branded Davy Crockett coonskin hat, everywhere and available to everyone for a dollar. We no longer felt so knowing and subversive. We'd been demoted to fans. Also, we knew we were getting too old to be doing this. When we discovered Bond, we were barely 12, but in the summer of 1963, we were 14, headed for New Trier High School in the fall. 12-year-olds pretending to be spies and make-out artists was clearly a fictional conceit, but now that we were going to be in high school, racy behavior was supposed to be on the menu for real. And then writing in the present day about her life, even though she's seen very few of the Bond films since she was a child and read none of the books that came out after Ian Fleming died, she still finds herself thinking about and seeing her life through the sort of template of James Bond throughout. And so she's writing this as a 63-year-old lawyer. She says, "Once I became a corporate lawyer, wearing fancy clothes, meeting zillionaires, traveling first class, I experienced a James Bond moment every month or so. Benign and imaginary, brief, silent, impromptu one-woman replays of our childhood games. The fictional template always lurked. I'd feel Bond girlish when I drove a European car with a stick shift on a European road, or when I ordered a martini at a revolving restaurant in Tokyo or overlooking Iguazu Falls in Brazil. It happened almost every time I passed through a big new airport, especially in China or the Middle East. If I'm alone in a high-rise hotel room at night in my underwear, dressing for dinner, putting on perfume, half-listening to CNN International, for a few seconds, I become Vesper Lind or Tatiana Romanova or Gayla Brand. Even though my adolescent immersion in the Bond books has made me freakishly alert to the subtext in glossy, sexy, chilly modern life, I know I'm not alone. The world must be crawling with make-believe secret agents. Every day and night in every city on Earth, aging children of both sexes fleetingly and half-consciously enact some version of the fantasy, dazzled by the cosmopolitan sheen, reassured by the platinum and black credit cards and exotically stamped passports and electronic devices in their attachés, hoping to feel tough and adventurous instead of brittle and existentially marooned. When I was born, before Bond girls and Playboy and the pill all invented simultaneously, An unmarried woman who indulged in guiltless sex was pathological, debased, wretched. Afterward, she was a standard-issue modern female. The world's obsession with brands is now so unremarkable that it no longer seems like an obsession. But a half century ago, James Bond's fetishes for obscure brand name merchandise, Tattinger champagne, Charvet shirts, Beretta pistols, Aston Martins, all of it, were peculiar. After Alex came out as gay in the late 1970s, he told me that Bond's extreme and snobbish brand loyalty had been one of the traits that made 007 seem, to a 12-year-old boy in Illinois in the early 60s, quasi-queer. Have you ever looked at the names of makeup? Chanel has lipstick colors called Intrigue, Secret, Captive, Incognito, Clandestine, and Fatale. Rupert Murdoch and Silvio Berlusconi and Dick Cheney and Steve Ballmer and Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un are all Bond villains. Richard Branson, Tom Ford, Tom Cruise, Donald Trump, Julian Assange, such a Fleming name, are Bond villains under the impression that they're actually Bonds. Valerie Plame Wilson and Carla Bruni Sarkozy and Madonna are, well, were in their 20s and 30s, Bond girls. And she goes on in this manner, finally. In September 2001, real life abruptly and completely flipped into full Bond mode. A wealthy freelancing supervillain in a secret underground lair, four hijacked American airliners, the Pentagon struck, iconic 110-story Manhattan skyscrapers vaporized. This was precisely the kind of absurd, baroque scheme that Commander Bond trotted the globe trying to prevent. Since then, half our politics and news have concerned fiendish, nihilistic masterminds in their hideouts, charismatic, stateless psychopaths who dream of committing spectacular mass murder for its own spectacular sake, with the battle against them fought by daring, steadfast agents of MI6 and CIA and special ops equipped with fantastic gadgets and licenses to kill. Afghan guerrillas in the heroin business, and Colombian guerrillas in the cocaine business, a world-famous Pakistani physicist selling nuclear secrets to rogue states, an American-born Colorado State grad in a beard and turban brainwashing killers by remote control from Yemen, Mexico commandeered by psychopathically depraved drug lords, entranced suicide bombers, proud videos of beheadings, a global confederacy of disparate madmen and terrorists. In the Bond novels, it was called Spectre. The director of the National Counterterrorism Center under Presidents Bush and Obama was a young former naval officer named, yes, Leiter. Truth is not stranger than fiction. It's exactly like the pulpy fiction I loved in junior high. Anyway, that's a bit of the Bond, thank you, the Bond stuff from the novel. I just want to say about this print you're about to see, which I haven't seen yet. It is the 50th anniversary of this film. This isn't a scratchy old print that has been being shown for 48 years. It's a brand new one. It is also, Jim, the projectionist, told me that which I found amazing and unbelievable, it is a digital Dolby soundtrack, and which means it must have been the first digital Dolby soundtrack in 1963, which is extraordinary. It's the first Bond movie, even though the Bond books had been coming out for 8 or 9 years by the time this film was made. The other interesting thing to imagine the alternative version of this film. Of course, you'll see Sean Connery and Ursula Andress. It almost got made with Cary Grant in the Sean Connery role and Julie Christie in the Ursula Andress role, which is a Dr. No I'd like to see as well. But anyway, enjoy it, and we'll talk a little more afterwards. Thank you very much. So that was the first James Bond movie. The 23rd is about to come out. It's slow as movies were 50 years ago, but it's it was unbelievably sexy, violent, all those things for its time. I think we can't understate how amazing it was to see, for instance, Ursula Andress come out of the water in that white bikini. And to see, you know, people murdered as callously and easily, and to see blood and all the rest. They obviously saved. It wasn't a big budget movie at the time. It cost $1 million to make, and they saved a tremendous amount of that budget, obviously, for the giant Dr. No atomic lair at the end, which has become the model for all Bond villain lairs. Ever since. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. And if before we go out to sign books and have dinner or go home, whatever we're going to do, happy to answer any questions about the book or anything else. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I finished your novel 2 days ago.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you.
It was reminiscent of another novel that I really enjoy, E. McEwan's Atonement.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say, yeah.
But in your case, you chose to use a first-person narration. He uses third-person omniscient. And when you take that route, doesn't that limit your ability to flesh out the other characters? It seems like it's all about Karen and what's in Karen's head. You don't have the opportunity to do head-hopping.
That's true.
Why did you choose the first-person narration?
It was the first first-person novel that I've written, and I chose it because given, first of all, Ian McEwan had already written Atonement. So I literally had that in mind. Also, given that I was more interested, I guess, in dealing with how keeping this secret for 45 years would affect an individual who has kept it and her life, and that was interesting to me. You're right. It is all about her, and this sort of waiting for the other shoe to. I don't want to give away those who haven't read it, but waiting for the shoe to drop for 45 years. And frankly, I was just interested in telling the story from her point of view, partly because my period from the story she's telling from the 1960s until now, among other things, it's also why I chose a woman. I was interested in how women's lives have changed in the last 45 years, which seemed to me more interesting than a man's. I was also interested in what. In terms of the plot, what information could be given away when? And I thought that was more interesting to do from a first person point of view. As you know, having read the book, there's a lot she doesn't know at the as she begins the book that she knows later in the book. And I thought having the first person narrator discover things along with the reader was an interesting way to go. But thanks for comparing it to. E. McEwan's book, which I was also a big fan of. Yes, sir.
Do you think that the book was could be appropriate for children?
My book would be maybe in a couple of years. How old are you? 12. Well, I would have read it when I was 12, so go for it. And these kids are reading James Bond when they're 12, so, you know, 12-year-olds, sure.
Kurt, can you talk a little bit about your deadline? There were several current references in the book, Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
Did you go back and add that in after the...
In that particular case, I did. I finished a draft of this book in the present day. My character's Karen has this granddaughter who's 17 years old, and is as the book reads is involved in Occupy movements. I finished this book actually when I was I had just finished it when I was last in Omaha in the beginning of, as I was reminded by Casey Logan, in the beginning of 2011, had just turned it in then, and had invented this. It's set, the present day in the book is 2013, 2014, and I had invented this movement that had of protesters. The granddaughter is going to protest the G20 summit in Miami, and then I'm editing the book last summer, last fall, and suddenly, there's this thing called Occupy that had been invented. So I did go back and fleck in a name for my movement, which didn't have that name. As I finished the manuscript, so I didn't want to go crazy, but here I had invented this movement, and suddenly it had a name, so I couldn't pretend as though it didn't, and I made those revisions last fall. I'm not such a Bond nerd, actually. I became a Bond nerd, God knows, as I was researching this book. I never read any James Bond book until I began researching this book. I'd seen the movies, and as a kid, I'm somewhat younger than my characters. So I was a James Bond movie fanatic, and Matt Helm, and Man from U.N.C.L.E., and I Spy, and I could go on. But I was not a James Bond nerd until I became one, for the purposes of this book. Yes, sir.
This might sound like a weird question. In watching the movie, I was so struck by how soundtrack played such an important part in the movie, and in movies in general, it becomes really part of the narrative, and even to the point of, like, you know, hitting the tarantula to the beat of the
boom, boom, boom.
I'm curious as to, when you're writing, does soundtrack play any part in your process, and how are you able to capture the same kind of narrative without the ability to use a soundtrack?
That's a great, complicated question. In terms of me personally, yeah, I need music all the time. Not all the time, but I have music playing when I'm writing all the time. And I find I can't write very well if I can only play instrumentals. I can't have lyrics, or I start listening to the lyrics. When I, years ago, 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, when I started working at Time Magazine, which was my first serious job, I realized I would play, for instance, when I write these big Time cover stories, I would time it so at the end, as I was getting to the end of staying up all night writing these cover stories, I would put on Aaron Copland, I would put on Appalachian Spring, so I could get into the proper mood. So I certainly have used soundtrack when I write. But it's a good point. I mean, you know, it's one of the, you know, fiction, as immersive as it is, as you know, you're involved in this universe, in this fantasy, this fantastic world, for hours and hours as a reader. You don't have the, one doesn't as a novelist have the soundtrack. So you're dealing, you know, we novelists are like sailboat builders as opposed to, you know, aircraft builders or something. We are still dealing with this old technology. But that said, there is, in fact, I put together a lot of the music from the book, most of the music from the book, which is available you can listen to it as you read the book if you'd like. So you have that available, and you can get to that through my website. So there's lots of music in this book that she listens to as a kid, as a girl, as a young woman in the 1960s. I ended up paying for two of I ended up paying to this if you quote more than two lines of a song, you have to pay the songwriters, and I decided I wanted more than two lines of a couple of songs, so I ended up paying for those. But and you know, you can, if you need the music, you can create, you can play along at home and have that music playing. But it's absolutely true. And what you see in this movie, of course, and they had that original John Barry James Bond theme, but they use it so sparingly, actually, compared to how wall-to-wall music films since have used music, obviously, much more densely.
Yeah, I have one about the lead character, Karen. Why did you choose it to be a female?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, one reason was I thought it was more interesting. Again, to the degree it's a story being told from the present day about the 60s and all that's happened since, I thought women's lives in general have changed a lot more dramatically in those 40 years than men's. So that was one reason. Also, the fact that there's a love triangle involved, I thought, or a couple of love triangles, actually, I thought it was more interesting to tell that from the woman's point of view. In the novels I've written before, I'd had significant female characters, and I'd enjoyed writing them and inventing them. So I decided to go, since I was also writing from the first person for the first time, whole hog, and challenge myself to do that. I don't know. I like women more than I like men, maybe. I don't know.
I just have a question about your writing process.
Uh-huh.
When you map out the book in your mind, do you put together a really detailed, structured outline that you want to follow, or is it more of a loose process for you when you're writing?
It's a fairly detailed outline. I mean, it's not as detailed. Yeah, it is a fairly detailed outline. It's a rough map with all of my notes and material, and this is going to happen then, and this is going to happen, and I know that when I start. But it's rough. It's more like a series of sketches rather than a fixed blueprint for me. So that I still, which is to say that it changes over the 2 years of writing a lot. I know that these characters are going to start as James Bond fanatics, that they're going to go to college together, that they're going to get involved in radical politics, that she's going to become a lawyer, and she's going to be. So I know the basics, but a lot of the details of what happened, because this is a particularly plotty, this particular book is pretty plotty, and what information happens when and who is lying when and all that, because, you know, once you get down to the brass tacks of scene by scene and chapter by chapter, I didn't know when I started that in chapter 22 this would happen. So unlike a screenplay, for instance, which in my experience of doing a few is much more carefully in great detail outlined scene by scene by scene before you begin writing. A novel, you have some more, or at least the way I do it, you have more leeway to figure it out as you go along. It's as though you begin with a sketch, and by the end of the book, you have the exact blueprints and working drawings done.
Kurt, I don't usually interject anything in these, but I can't resist this one. Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Daniel Craig, George Lazenby. Who's your favorite Bond?
I got to say, I mean, seeing the 31-year-old Sean Connery is kind of amazing. He was great, sure. But these last two Daniel Craig movies, I think Daniel Craig is an awesome James Bond, and to my taste, the best one since Sean Connery. I actually got to meet Daniel Craig recently, and he was very impressive, although short.
We probably have time for maybe one more question.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I'm curious, given the fact that clearly film stories informed or were the inspiration for setting up the story, do you think that the story in your book would lend itself to being told in a film?
These characters go to the James Bond movies, but in fact they were much more into the James Bond books. That's what really got them obsessed and excited. But to your question of would it be a movie? Yes, it could be, and perhaps will be, and the people who represent me in Hollywood are talking to people about, and I'm actually talking to people about whether it should be, for instance, a six-part miniseries, which I think would be great, or whether it should be a two-hour film. But yeah, I think it's it absolutely could be a film. And for instance, if Meryl Streep wanted to play Karen Hollander, and if, say, her daughter, Mamie Gummer, an actress, wanted to play the young Karen Hollander in the 1960s, I could see that, yes. Yes, definitely. But but more seriously, I mean, you write books as books. I do anyway. I don't write them as, oh, how could this be a movie? As it happens, this one, I think, would be easier to make as a movie than probably my other two novels would be. But sure, we'll see. But my approach to that is always. I discount that possibility to zero because it's show business, and whereas with books, they let me write them and then they publish them, and it's pretty great. Unlike movies. I guess one more question. Yes, madam.
As a man, when you write as a woman, how do you do that?
I want to ask you, you're dressed like Ursula Andress in that movie we just saw, and
purpose.
The man with you is in black tie.
Yes.
So thank you for dressing for the occasion.
You're very welcome.
How do I write as a person from the 19th century or about people from the 19th century or people from other French people or all these things that I'm not? I mean, I have lived for the last 20 years with three women, my two daughters and my wife. Not three women. I mean, my daughters are now women, but it's not as interesting as that at first sounded. I think I know how women think, it's a matter of fictionally imagining yourself into other minds and other lives. In the particular case of this book, I had my wife, as always, is my first reader of it. My daughters both read it in manuscript. My two editors are both women. My agent is a woman. So those were really the first half dozen readers of the manuscript, and I got plenty of advice on where I had perhaps gone wrong, in particular, for instance, my younger daughter read the manuscript, and I had some scenes with the 17-year-old granddaughter that she said, "Daddy, she would never do that," and I changed it accordingly. So, again, I mean, every day I sat down and spent 4 or 5 hours imagining myself as this woman, and for better or worse, I think after a while I learned how I thought she would think, a woman would think, and it was interesting, actually. I mean, I think I did it okay, and the women who read the book mostly think I did it okay. It was very interesting, in particular, to imagine this woman of her age. At one point when the manuscript was much longer, as manuscripts always are, than finished books, I'd imagined her. I had more about her in the 1960s and in the 1970s, going to work. And feeling, by that point in the story and in the writing process, feeling the exasperation of a 25-year-old woman going to the man's world of being a lawyer in 1973, that was the moment when I felt like I really am getting this, because I would end the day feeling so sort of angry and frustrated at what she was feeling as a 25-year-old in 1974. So at that point, I sort of felt as though, wow, I guess I do have this. I need a drink just to deal with my anger over what she was feeling at that point. But it's, you try your best to as I say, imagine people and get inside the heads of people unlike who one is. Otherwise, you know, everybody I write about would be a 57-year-old man living in 2012. And how interesting would that be, you know?
Kurt, I promise Casey we'd wrap this up. It's David. And we really appreciate your coming to Film Streams. It's great of you to do this. One quick question. It's always interesting to hear your observations about Omaha as a native Omahan. And I saw a recent quote from you saying you were recommending to artists that they moved to Omaha. And I just wondered what your thoughts are about Omaha now and that quote.
Well, it was true. It is true. I mean, when you know, young painters, filmmakers, whomever, say, oh, how am I going to live? How am I going to get started? And I said, well, you know, New York is still a great place. However, when I moved to New York and I could get a two-bedroom apartment with a roommate for $400, that was a way to be, you could be, you know, a young writer. I really do, for particular kinds of people, and occasionally even my children, I say a place like this that is really a lot less expensive to live, and B, a place that isn't, that is still in the process of happening in a way, it seems to me, in terms of its cult, as a cultural center, it's extraordinary what's happening here to me. I mean, this thing is evidence of that, this place. And so I don't think I've convinced, I know that's not true. I have convinced one person to come here, to move here. But I'm still working on it. When people say, oh, should I move so far out in Queens that it'll take me 2 hours to get to where, I say, no, just go to a place like Omaha, which is, you know, more interesting than Eastern Queens to me. But so I think it's I think what's happening here is extraordinary, and if I were 22, I might well have never left, or certainly as say Rachel Jacobson did, come back here after living in New York. Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And if you haven't read the book yet, I hope you enjoy it.
We've heard a special program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. Today's special guest was Kurt Anderson, the host of Studio 360 and author of the new novel, True Believers. Mr. Anderson was heard in a book reading and question and answer session, which followed a special screening of the first James Bond film, Dr. No, starring Sean Connery and Ursula Andress, with Joseph Wiseman in the title role. This program, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the release of the first film in the James Bond series, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, August 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Scott Kuhl, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.